Hi, and welcome to the Cutaneous Connection, a podcast from the staff at Dermatology Times, aiming to provide you with the latest news in dermatology, exclusive interviews with leading experts, and a glimpse at what goes on behind the scenes of clinical trials, research, and innovation. In today's episode, Renata Block, a physician assistant from Chicago, Illinois, and host of Dermatology Times' Derm Dispatch video series, sits down with indolent systemic mastocytosis patient advocate, Suki Tip. Tip's symptoms began in 2015 with intensely pruritic lesions on her legs that she initially associated with shaving or environmental exposures. In their discussion, Block and Tip discussed the clinical, emotional, and financial toll of delayed diagnosis in hopes of providing education and hope for both patients and clinicians.
Hey everyone, Renata Block here. I am sitting down with Suki Tip. She is from Troy, Alabama, and a very strong patient advocate of systemic mastocytosis. Suki, you're going to share with us your journey of developing the disease, the frustration of finally getting diagnosed with it, because I think you were getting the symptoms around 2015 and your final diagnosis came in 2017. So that journey of 2 years of the unknown is beyond frustrating for patients as well as clinicians. But I want to share your story in regards to what you've been through and tell us a general background of your diagnosis of indolent systemic mastocytosis.
Sure, I'd be happy to. It started for me, like you said, before I got diagnosed. I didn't know that I was having symptoms because I didn't know what anaphylaxis was. I wasn't sure about allergies. I'd never had allergies really per se before. And so I was having a few symptoms that I now know were related to mastocytosis. The first things were actually skin issues. I was having itching and then some hives on my legs, and I thought it was related to shaving. So I would switch out my razor every time. I would always get a new razor, or I was changing out shaving gel or creams or not using any at all and thinking, you know, this will help. But the itching was intense. And then I started getting brown spots. I didn't know what they were. I asked, I finally, when I got a lot of them, I asked my general practitioner, and he was like, oh, it looks like folliculitis. And I was like, well, it itches really bad, like super intense. And then these red spots turn into these brown spots. And he was like, well, it looks like scarring. It looks like folliculitis. And then you're scratching, inflammation, and then it's scarring over. So as a patient who before never asked questions, I just went with it. And I was like, okay, well, this is what we're going with.
Let me ask you though, because when it started on the legs specifically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you
yes.
thought it was the shaving. What led you to believe that? Were you going like on social media and online and being like, why am I getting this itchy rash on my legs? And this is what I have to do. So were you looking for guidance on the internet? So that's my first question.
Mm-hmm.
And then how long did it take you to go to your primary care when the rash started to when you're like, okay, nothing's working?
Mm-hmm. So I didn't start looking online or anything like that at first. Maybe I should have. Maybe I would have found something, but I correlated it to shaving, or maybe if I got in a swimming pool, sometimes my legs would have this happen. We live sort of near the Gulf, and so we would go to the beach and sometimes the salt water. So it was like things like that. I thought, oh, well, I've shaved recently, and then maybe something is getting into, maybe I have some little abrasions.
You were thinking.
Right. I was trying to decide what it was.
Right. But, and again, this is what we do as humans,
mm-hmm.
right? Like X produces Y, you know?
Right.
But you know, you've never had this before, and
mm-hmm.
it's not uncommon for something to appear. You can get something tomorrow
mm-hmm.
that you've never experienced before. But when you went to the primary care physician, you got a prescription, and
mm-hmm.
obviously that didn't work. But my
right.
other question is, did it go beyond the rash? Because mastocytosis is pretty much a buildup of mast cells. It's
mm-hmm.
overproduction. It's like, it's just complete buildup, but it can lead to not only skin rashes as you experience,
mm-hmm.
but it can also lead to other systemic like abdominal pain or mood swings or night sweats or headaches. Like, how soon after the rash did that start? Number one. And number two, was the rash always just on the legs?
So I didn't realize at the time that the rash maybe would be connected to something else, some of these other symptoms. And
Why would you?
like why would me being itchy on my skin have anything to do with the intense stomach pain I'm having at times? I did correlate maybe that some of the flushing I was having might have something to do with it, but the fact that the rashes started on the legs and my flushing was usually like chest up, and like my ears would just, especially one ear, would just turn bright red and just, flush. So they were kind of far apart on the body. So like maybe that's not related. And sometimes they would happen at similar or same times. Other times I would have, a rash sort of issue, and then I wouldn't have the flushing, or I wouldn't have the GI pain. I wouldn't have the sort of mental disturbances. So it was hard for me to really correlate those things as being something that were related. So when I would go to a specialist, if I go to a GI doctor for the stomach pain, or the diarrhea that you're having, they don't ask you about your skin, right? They don't ask you if you're having headaches. They don't ask you about any of those things. When I go to the dermatologist, or well, and mine was mostly my PCP, because we didn't think I needed to get to a dermatologist at that point. But in general, you go to a dermatologist, you talk about your skin. You go to the dentist, you talk about your teeth. You don't tell them all of the other things. You have such a short window to spend with the professional
Right.
that you try not to monopolize their time and waste it, which is that was what I thought it would be, is wasting time of a professional to tell them all of these other things. It can seem quite overwhelming. And I honestly, at that time, did not connect any of it.
So when you went to the primary care and you started getting the GI, that's when they referred you to GI specialist.
Yes,
And I
yes.
also know you went to an allergist. And
Yes.
I also know that you tried to get into a dermatologist.
I started really seeking a lot more help after I experienced my first full-blown anaphylactic shock, to a wasp sting. And so that, I was in critical care for 10 days. Then that got me a pretty quick appointment at an allergist. And so the allergist, thankfully, had seen a patient with SM before. And so he sort of recognized and was like, well, maybe this is what you have. He said he was trying to get me into different specialties, because he could only do a certain amount of testing. So I was going to go get a bone marrow biopsy. I was going to go to another GI to get another colonoscopy and endoscopy and try to get some biopsies there. But he was a he. So from his experience, some of the ways to get diagnosed more quickly is a skin punch biopsy.
Okay.
So I went to a dermatologist locally, and that I requested to have a skin punch biopsy. But when she looked at it, she was like, I really don't think that's what that is. So, which
Interesting.
at that time I was still fairly naive in all of the everything mastocytosis related. So I was like, okay, well, she doesn't think that's what it is. And the allergist had said, sometimes people have skin issues, sometimes they don't. So I, in my naivety, just was like, well, okay, we'll just do the next thing. So the dermatology appointment didn't get me very far. I did get a little bit of, I got a steroid cream, to put on some of the rashes, but it was more focused on, oh, this rash, rather than looking at the brown spots. Those were because they
Interesting.
look sort of like little flat moles, or they look
Right.
like a freckle, a large freckle,
Right.
which I do also have freckles as a redhead with fair skin. I do also have freckles. So I can understand where it might be hard to differentiate, but
So that's interesting. Was, and then looking back with the dermatology appointment, I mean, was there anything to biopsy at that time? Because if this rash was coming and going, you, as a provider, we want to capture the biopsy when the rash is active. So, and again, I'm kind of maybe was
And
that.
that's hard to catch. It's hard to
Yeah.
catch that when you're having. So for me, and I understand by being in a lot of the support groups for quite a few patients, not everyone, but you get this this rash, and then and it's a lot of times it's like little hives, like little spots that pop up, and they itch intensely. For me, I'm one of the patients that after it's really itchy and the redness goes away, there's a brown spot, so the cutaneous mastocytosis. So I'm one that was left with those brown spots. Not everybody is. There are patients that, just sort of get the rash and then it goes away. But for me, the redness turned into the cutaneous mastocytosis on my skin.
Okay, so as far as like the steroid cream, you did that. Did they give you any type of antihistamine at high doses? I mean, you were probably going through the algorithm of, what we call urticaria or hives treatment. Right. And we start with, antihistamines and four times a day, and you were seeing an allergist. So you were going through the process probably of these prescriptions or this guidance, but you were still getting the GI symptoms, which then you were seeing a GI specialist, which then you were getting headaches or mood swings or anything else, and you were seeing your primary care. So there was any collaboration between the three. Or there was not, because you just saw there were three individual things happening at the same time.
Right. So I there was not a lot of collaboration. Now my PCP, he's really great about, getting the reports back from each of the doctors. But at that point I still was not diagnosed. And so yes, the allergist put me on all types of antihistamines and
And
mast
nothing
cell
worked.
stabilizers, but it wasn't working. I wasn't really at high enough doses, so he kept upping them. One thing that did sort of slow everything down was he put me on doxepin, and he did put me on quite a high dose of that. I was on 125 milligrams of doxepin, which it knocks you out, like you sleep. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. So I was kind of in that sort of realm.
And
It
then you got
did
the
lower
EpiPen.
the Yes, I did have EpiPens. He did prescribe me EpiPens right away because, like I said, I did have a full-blown anaphylactic shock, heart stopping, coded three times. Like it was definitely that was a big issue. And
And
so, yes, I carried EpiPens.
you notice that getting progressively worse. Like how many EpiPens did you go through in amount of time, like 12 months?
Well, so at my worst, it was 99 EpiPens
In 1 year?
in 1 year. Yes.
Wow. So how
Yes.
often was that? Because 99 EpiPens is a
I
lot.
mean, it's hard to even calculate how it's hard. I used to keep it in a calendar, but my husband was really great about trying to like take care of me because honestly, we have children and it was very frightening. And then like sometimes I could give myself an EpiPen, but sometimes I was at the point that the kids had to do it. So I'm like out and they have to give me an EpiPen, which
So
is
this was getting progressively worse. And
yes.
I read that one day you eat a strawberry and you're fine. The next day you eat a strawberry and you have a reaction. And it was like a constant fear of, what am I eating? What am I touching? What am I being exposed to that's going to cause a trigger that I've never had triggers before?
What's going to be next, right?
What's going to be
That's
next?
sort of where I was living, is what's the next thing? And I quickly lost most, like so many foods. You don't think about water, like somebody's going to be allergic to water, but I was down to two safe types of water that I could drink, two types
And
of
you were
bottled water that I could
eliminating
drink, and like
everything.
six foods that were safe that I knew, okay, these aren't causing an issue. I got to the point where when you're living in fear almost, because you don't know what's going to cause your throat to close up next, you're very cautious. And so I started noticing things like, something might not have taste like it used to, or it might not smell like it did before. So it's almost like my body was saying, hey, watch out, this might be something. So I got fairly good at, if I could put something in my mouth and it had a taste that was not the typical taste that I recall from before, then I would just spit it out and not swallow it. So that kind of, when I got to that point where I could do that kind of helped and like slowed down some of those things. But I did get to the point where it wasn't just foods for me, not just insect bites, but also things like Someone could have washed their clothes in a certain detergent and I walk by them. That could trigger it. Somebody could be chewing a peppermint gum and I get too close and that's it. I got to where I couldn't go to the grocery store because all of the chemicals that are being used, it just, I got to that point. I was wearing a mask before COVID. If I did have to go anywhere, like if I had to go to a doctor's appointment or something like that, I was having to wear a mask and it was just, it was frightening. So that's kind of the place that I was in.
Let me ask you this, because the emotional toll on this and the impact, of your social life, and you have kids, it's like you the impact of what was happening before that diagnosis must have been just traumatic and emotional toll. Do you feel practitioners need to pay more attention regarding of not only what they see or what they hear of the symptoms, but how it's affecting you emotionally, because I think that is incredibly important.
Yes, I do feel like it's a huge factor. And some emotional things come from the fact that you have this, rare disease, and a lot of practitioners don't really know that much about it. They might have had a, couple lessons or, read something here or there, but as far as the big picture, I have found that there's not a lot of practitioners that are extremely familiar with it. So, as the patient who has had to educate yourself, it's almost like this weight. Is the doctor going to take me seriously? Do they believe in systemic mastocytosis because, or do they believe that I might have it because it's so rare, they've never seen anyone. I've had a practitioner say to me in the ER that there is no way that that's what you have. And this
Interesting.
is after I'm completely diagnosed and like, on all the right meds at this point. He was like, there's no way that's what you have, and acted like, I was there for some other reason or just needed
Interesting.
attention. And that takes an emotional toll itself.
Right.
But also, when you are in these flares, something that is just not discussed enough, and partly because patients are maybe afraid to talk to the doctors about it because they think, oh, if I tell them I'm having mental health issues, they may not take me seriously. And you're already, a little bit timid about, are they going to take this mastocytosis seriously in the first place? That adding that next degree is, it's just one more thing. So a lot of patients, and I've noticed this in our support group, we actually had a discussion in the last week that a lot of patients don't want to talk about the fact that we may get extremely depressed. And it's not all the time. I'm not all the time depressed. It's when I'm experiencing the symptoms. Or I might, lash out in just something that was not my nature and it's not my character to just say something really angry, just explode. That wasn't something that was typical of me. And thankfully, my husband realized, hey, this is not her. This has got to be something else going on.
Right.
But everybody's not blessed with that. They just think, oh, they've lost their mind or something
Yeah.
mental health is going on.
There's
But
so much stigma of mental health, and it's like you're afraid of not being taken seriously and thinking that you are mentally ill, when really that quality of life and the emotional toll that these symptoms are causing. I want to ask you, what advice can you give clinicians when the patient is in the office? Like, what is like a pearl that you can give us in regards to, as a patient, what should we be doing better?
So for me, I know that when a practitioner says, I don't really know that much about it, and then let's ask me to help them or ask me to tell them more about it, that it's almost like this weight is lifted off. Especially when I've had practitioners say, I don't know, but I promise I'm going to learn about it and look into it so that the next time you come in here, I will be more informed. Those, I would much rather have a doctor or a nurse practitioner, PA, do that than to pretend. I have found that there are a lot of practitioners that they pretend like they know what they're do what like they know what they're what's going on or what you're going through. And that's not helpful.
Right. I understand that. And we can't know everything. And I think transparency is incredibly important to be transparent with your patient, but also it sets up a collaboration with the patient because it's not a cookie cutter diagnosis. And the treatment may be the same, but the symptoms may be different. The emotional toll might have a different level. You have to understand that not everybody is the same. I want to ask you, did you hesitate to seek medical care because of cost? Did you feel that that was an issue in regards to maybe not going to see someone?
So yes, they the cost, just being for real here, it's outrageous. Not just the copays, and not just for your visit copay, and then your all of the when you're prescribed so many prescriptions for high dose antihistamines. Well, the antihistamines that you get over the counter are expensive, and especially if you're taking 4 or 5 times more than
Right.
the typical person. But still, even if you get it prescribed, that's still expensive. So when you're being thrown into it and have just so many things, and I quickly became unable to work. So we went from a home that's two incomes, and I was blessed to have a pretty great income, but we had recently built a house. We had children, four kids, and depended on my income. So when I had, it was too dangerous for me to work because I couldn't be in around other people or in different places that were not safe. We lost that income as well. And so that was a huge toll on our family. We had to start dipping into savings and
Right.
tell our kids, look, we're going to have to use part of the college funds because we've got to make this work.
Did you not get some medication because of the cost?
Some of them that I, which, I at the time thought, well, maybe this one's not doing as well as another one. Yeah, there were some that I wouldn't use or some that I would ration.
Right. Is this
So,
something you would
especially like
talk?
chromal and sodium, that was one that, yeah, I probably should have taken more
Right.
than what I was taking, but it cost so much and it was so hard to get that I would try to ration it a little bit, make it go a little bit longer.
So you would take the full dose, you would, right. And I have a lot of, unfortunately, patients doing that. And I tell them, as a provider, you need to inform me of the difficulty you're having about getting these medications. Because if I don't know, then I can't pivot, right? And did you talk to your practitioner about that challenged? Were they open and helping you, or were they saying, no, this is all I can do. You must take this. I just want to get a pulse on that, just because I think it's so important to make sure that you are getting the treatment that we prescribe. But if it's something that's not affordable, then as a prescriber, we need to pivot and accommodate.
So yeah, I did feel, well, at one point I was just, you get to the point where, well, why aren't you taking the medicine that you're supposed to, or why didn't you get it filled when you needed to? Well, you have to get honest, and that's hard, especially for me. I was never in a position where, I was making six figures. So, you think about that, and then that's gone. You don't really qualify because my husband has a great job too. Well, you have to think about the fact that we're not in a place to sell our home. The market's not great for that right now. We've lost one income, but at the same time, my husband's income was higher than what might be considered. Well, they should still be able to afford their medicine. But you don't know what somebody's just had to walk out of or let go.
Right.
So that was one thing that was a little bit challenging. Some when you have some of the programs where you can ask for assistance or get a lower copay or things like that, sometimes there's you have to wiggle around to find out how to make that work. And honestly, just the stigma of asking for help with it was hard.
The medication you're on now, is helping. And it's really,
Oh, tremendously.
it's changed your life. And I'm very excited because really there was not a lot of treatment options out there until recently. They've been FDA approved, and specifically the one that you're
I
on.
started the medication in a clinical trial. I have noticed that there are some patients that are taking it now that it's been approved and they're diagnosed, that have mentioned it, but then there's patients that say, oh, well, you can get, help with that. And so I'm not positive what the costs are, with or without insurance, but I do know that there are programs, in place to help people that need it.
And you mentioned something extremely important. These clinical trials, I think, are a lifeline for a lot of patients who don't have options in regards to a diagnosis like this. So, to give our listeners some context, it's one in 10,000 individuals. It's a rare diagnosis. However, I got a feeling people like you, shedding light on this diagnosis. I feel it is often misdiagnosed and not understood enough. And I feel that one to 10,000 will be a lot higher in a few
I
years.
believe that 100%. I live in a town of 30,000 people, and it's a university town, a small university. So if that gives you a perspective on, it's a small town. But in the last 2 years, there have been five other people that have been diagnosed with mastocytosis, with systemic mastocytosis. So it's not an environmental factor. That tells me that the doctor educating himself and becoming more aware has played a role in those people being diagnosed.
Right.
So,
And that's exactly why I wanted to talk to you, because I want to bring it on the dermatology forefront regarding these patients coming in with hives, maybe hives on the lower extremities or in just a location or flushing or anything like that. Is again, when we see the skin, it's like the window. It's the window to what's happening within, because a lot of diseases are systemic and they are produced on the skin. And as we are learning more about genetics and cellular structure of the pathophysiology of these diseases, we're understanding the why the hives are coming, right? This is a mutation of the KIT gene, and this is something that you got diagnosed in later in life. You had four kids, you had married, all that. And all of a sudden it just came on. And the trigger, who knows what turned this gene on.
I do feel blessed to be living in a time with the medications that we have now, but I was at a place of such despair. And just honestly, I was ready to give up because it was just misery. And I was just tired. I was tired of fighting it. I was ready to give up. I was ready to let the next anaphylaxis just take me out. Thankfully, my husband and kids were like, we're not doing that. We're just going to keep pushing forward and fighting forward. So, with the help of finding a doctor to help me and getting in this trial, it has literally changed my life.
So the medicine that you're on is called avapritinib. How did you find out about this clinical trial? Was it through the allergist?
A doctor that was fairly new at University of Alabama in Birmingham. I started seeing him. He's an oncologist. I essentially begged him to help me, is what happened. And then he found the clinical trial. He was like, I really feel positive about this medication. He looked at it from the, molecular scientific level and was like, I feel really good. Like, I feel great about this. So he signed UAB up to be a host site. And I was so desperate that I joined it, but he's the
How
one
soon
that
did you
got me
start
signed
getting
up.
better after taking the medicine?
For me, I think it was probably 6 months to 8 months before I was like, yes, this is really doing something.
Good.
And
Life
then after
changing.
that, I quickly started the brown start spots started to actually fade. I thought that was going to, I'm going to be left with those spots. It was an outward sort of thing, which at that point, they were not just on my legs. They were all the way up,
Oh my God.
about to armpits. I had a few on my arms as well, but they started to fade.
So symptoms started getting better 6 to 8 months, and you're talking the hives, the itch, the
All
abdominal
of
pain,
it.
all of it. Oh, that's just incredible.
Yes.
So I'm, this drug is exciting. This conversation that we're having today is really going to bring this disease to the forefront to the dermatologists, to the derm NPs and PAs to recognize this disease. And I know you are a strong advocate. What are you doing to help educate people on the importance of this disease? And what can you recommend to dermatology providers?
I'm trying to do everything that I can. Any opportunity I get to share my story, even as hard or as ugly or you want to kind of keep your crazy in your box, I'm trying to share whenever I can because I don't want patients that are undergoing trying to get diagnosed now or patients in the future. I hope that by sharing my story, that maybe people that might stop at the MCAS diagnosis, maybe we go a little bit further to make sure it's, hey, the symptoms are so similar. Make sure that you don't have systemic mastocytosis because, honestly, I feel blessed to have systemic mastocytosis in a time where there's medication that can help me. People need to know that it's out there, it exists, and become educated on it so that patients can be treated and not have to suffer.
That's sound advice. I appreciate the time that you took out of your busy day to talk to me and really educate the dermatology community on this disease and the recognition and really the treatment options. It's an exciting time and it's been a life changer for you. So
Yes.
thank you, Suki.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. And, I appreciate you wanting to bring awareness to it as well.
Like this podcast, have suggestions, or want to participate in future episodes? Contact our team at dteditor@mmhgroup.com. For more Dermatology Times content, from articles to videos and podcasts, visit www.dermatologytimes.com.